This is Digital Story Podcast number 1046, April 7th, 2026. Today's theme is Journey to the Dark Side of the Moon. I'm Derek Story. On April 1st, 2026, Artemis II launched for a historic 10-day crewed mission orbiting the moon, making it the first human return to deep space since 1972. The pictures from the mission have been stunning. Today we will learn about the gear they are using and hear from the astronauts themselves. I hope you enjoy the show. So we have a crew of four very brave voyagers: Reed Weissman, Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Jeremy Hansen, and they are testing NASA's Orion spacecraft and the SLS rocket. This mission will break records, flying further than any humans before, to prepare for future sustainable lunar exploration. For their image making, the crew has 32 cameras aboard the Artemis II. Eliminating the cameras that are mounted on the spacecraft itself, the four astronauts aboard have 17 handheld photo-taking devices at their disposal, including a Nikon D5 DSLR, a Nikon Z9 mirrorless camera, GoPros, and iPhones. We'll talk more about the iPhones in the next story. Lenses include the Nikon AFS Nikkor 14-24 f2.8 GED, the Nikon AF Nikkor 35mm f2D, and the Nikon AFS 800-400 f4.5-5.6 EDVR. Now, I want to talk about the equipment for a minute. We're going to get into other aspects of this mission. I've been listening all day today as I record this, and I have some wonderful, wonderful snippets for you from Mission Control and from the astronauts themselves talking about their process, talking about what they're seeing. It's really amazing. I mean, it's absolutely amazing when you think about it. But going back to the equipment, we have a couple of Nikon D5s, the Z9 mirrorless, the GoPros, and the iPhones. So I think it's very interesting that the big pictures that we have seen so far, the super impressive ones, have been taken with a DSLR. Now, DSLRs are dead. We all know that, right? And I'm doing this with my tongue firmly implanted in my cheek. Nikon D5s with lenses that you and I could go out and buy right now if we wanted to. Very standard stuff, the 14-24, the 35mm f2, an 80-400mm 4.5-5.6. I mean, it's amazing to me that with all the technology and all the planning and everything that this mission encompasses, that they are using equipment for the imagery. And this imagery has been amazing that you or I could get our hands on right now. I love that. I absolutely love that. I just think it's fantastic. And I haven't even got to the iPhone stuff yet. All right, let's talk a little bit about their preparation, not only with the gear itself, but these pictures have been very good. For those of you that have been following this story, they have been excellent shots. How did that happen? Well, NASA selected National Geographic to partner with. That's the short answer. Nat Geo has collaborated with NASA to train the crew, and they've been doing this 2025 and 2026, acting as a mini astronaut film school. Now, it should be, I think, an astronaut mini film school, but okay. I didn't write that phrase, someone else did. But a mini astronaut film school. Very short astronauts, right? Staff taught astronauts storytelling techniques, cinematic videography, and social media skills for documenting this lunar mission. The crew will act as photographers and filmmakers during the journey. And the way that this works is they work in pairs. So And it's fascinating when you listen to them because, you know, the feed was live, right? So we got to hear things as they were doing it. And so a pair would be at Windows, you know, a lot of times Window 3 and Window 4. There's four windows in the Orion. So one person would have the D5, essentially, with the zoom lens, an 80 to 400 millimeter zoom lens. And then the other person would be using their personal computing device. We don't know what that is, or at least I don't know what that is right now, to be taking notes, recording voice, doing all that kind of stuff. And they would work as pairs. Now, one of the reasons why I think this is such a good idea is because you have two sets of eyes. Now, they have also received extensive training in geology, and they've been studying the moon, of course. However, once you get up in that capsule and you're looking at the moon itself, as you will hear from some of the dialogue that I'm going to share with you, it's not as easy as it was, you know, back home when you're looking at a blow-up globe of the moon and identifying certain landmarks. So two sets of eyes really do help for them to identify what they're seeing in real time. Now, of course, the photographs and, you know, the position of the capsule and all that kind of stuff, it will be absolutely right when they go through all the data. But when we're listening to the reports in real time, I thought they did a tremendously good job of having us be there with them in the capsule while they're recording this journey. And I thought it was tremendous. So then two would work the window. Two would be doing updates back to mission control. And then after a certain period of time, they would switch. So then the other two would come away from the windows. And one of my favorite quotes about that, when it was time to switch, mission control said this: "Time to swap positions at the window and take your SD cards with you." You just go, take your SD cards with you. Again, using stuff that you and I have in our camera bags, you know, and don't lose that SD card, especially in zero gravity, right? That thing could float off, and who knows if you would find it again in the capsule. Another one was when they were getting closer to the moon. It was super bright. It was super bright in the window. So another quote that I pulled out was, "The moon is so bright in window 4 that they had to temporarily cover it with a t-shirt." With a t-shirt. That's right. There wasn't any special window covering for this situation. It was just bright, and they had to use a t-shirt to cover it. It's not that much different than you and I going on a workshop, other than they're in this capsule that's the size of two minivans, and they're going to be there for 10 days. They're only, you know, what, about halfway through the trip now. I just love this. You know, this is such great stuff. Let's talk a little bit about some of the famous images that we have already seen. I'm going to start out with the one that everyone was seeing, which is the new portrait of planet Earth. It's actually titled ART002E00192, and it's taken on April 3rd. A view of Earth taken by Artemis II commander Reid Wiseman from one of the Orion spacecraft's windows after completing the translunar injection burn on April 2nd. The image features two auroras, top right and bottom left, and the light from the bottom right is visible as the Earth eclipses the Sun. Now, he used the Nikon D5 with the Nikkor AFS 14-24mm f2.8 at 22mm f4.0, a quarter of a second at ISO 51,200. Now, the reason why the ISO was so high was because the illumination of the planet was a reflection, right? So it was a reflection. It wasn't direct light on Earth. It was a reflection onto Earth. So the light was very low, but yet, you know, these D5s, you know, they do a great job in that situation, and that image is spectacular. Another image that I really like, and I might like it a little bit more. I know the first image is iconic, but this image taken in the same session, again by Reid Wiseman, is a view of the Earth from one of the Orion spacecraft's four main windows, with Earth framed by the window, and it's also showing the interior of the capsule. We all love frames, right? We all love really nice framing. This is the ultimate framing job, where you have planet Earth framed by the inside of a space capsule, and you can actually see detail of the capsule inside. And for that shot, that was also with the Nikon D5. They used the 35mm f2 at 1/250th of a second ISO 250. Iconic images that I know I'll be looking at for years to come. I wouldn't mind getting a poster, actually, of the second one. And I'm sure all of that stuff is going to be available in time. So what I'd like to do now is just share some audio from Mission Control, from the astronauts themselves, talking about taking pictures, talking about the gear, talking about what they're seeing, because they are the persons who are there. They are the storytellers. So let's let the storytellers tell some of the story. I hope you enjoy this audio, and then I'll go into our next story from there.
The lunar flyby of the Artemis II crew, the first humans to fly by the moon in over 50 years. Orion launched 4 days, 21 hours, and 30 minutes ago atop the SLS rocket, Space Launch System rocket from Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
We definitely noted how much more you can see with the zoom lens. Even though we have a great visible eye image, there's just a lot of texture that just pops right out at you when you can zoom in. So almost just using it like a telescope, the camera lens. We really enjoyed our discussion time. That was a great innovation on the lunar targeting plan. We were both able to describe a lot more kind of with flow, I would say, when we were talking to each other. And it was also, we sort of were able to bounce ideas off of each other and come to new conclusions. We had, I think, a very successful talking through of some contacts between different color areas, both in the Mare and in the Highlands, and we identified some really unique texture areas as well.
Another rundown of just how this flyby is choreographed inside the spacecraft today. So these activities have been timelined, and there are these 5 blocks of time during which the crew is going to be observing the moon from Orion's windows. Now we are just coming up on the end of the second block, and we'll start the third soon. So at any time during those blocks, two members are at the windows working in a pair. One is taking photos from window 2 and has a blue shroud over the window to help prevent any reflections from inside the spacecraft. They are also using an 80 to 400 millimeter zoom lens. And the other astronaut on the window team will be in window 3 using their portable computing device to make annotations. Now, again, both of those crew members are making audio recordings of what they are seeing, and we are not hearing that right now. Those are going to be downlinked later to the science team, who will evaluate them and use that data to inform our understanding of the moon. Those two crew members at the windows swap roles.
Integrity Houston, it is time for another swap between the cabin and the window teams. So we have 15 minutes of handover time, and then we will expect Jeremy and Reed at the windows and Christina and Victor at the cabin.
I was just showing you is an 8X iPhone out the docking hatch for the high grazing angle. It's just amazing.
We love it. Thank you.
There are also GoPros on each of the solar arrays on Orion, and that's where this view is coming from right now. We have an interior camera of the crew as well, but they have dimmed the cabin lights. They've actually turned off the cabin lights to allow them to better see outside of the spacecraft. This also helps prevent any reflections from lights inside the spacecraft reflecting onto the windows while they are photographing the moon. One of the items you heard mentioned was Oriental Basin. This has been a very exciting opportunity for the crew. They have all been very excited about seeing Oriental, as well as the science team has been looking forward to it. It is known as the Grand Canyon of the Moon, as we discussed earlier. From the pictures, the science team is hoping that the crew will take centered images of the entire basin and surrounding craters in a single frame, but also use those 80 to 400 millimeter zoom lenses to create a mosaic entire basin. With their unaided eyes, the science team is hoping the crew will describe Southern Dark Annual Ring, which you heard Reed just describing, as well as any color, albedo, texture, or topography across the Mare Patches and Ring Mountains. Science team reports that the observations will be used to study the geologic evolution of the youngest lunar basin and to inform formation hypotheses for the annular ring. And again, another fun fact about Oriental is the diameter is the same distance between Johnson Space Center, where we are today, and Kennedy Space Center, where the crew launched on April 1st. We're in the Artemis Mission Control Room at Johnson Space Center, getting our preliminary contact with Orion, that acquisition of signal coming after a 40-minute loss of signal, during which the crew was flying behind the moon, out of contact with anyone on Earth. We are getting our first views from Orion after the loss of signal. Orion has come back around the other side of the moon, and that little crescent that you see is Earth, over 252,000 miles away. With this transit complete, lunar flyby continues, but Orion has also technically begun its journey home. Right now, the crew are getting a few moments to enjoy and take photos of Earthrise for themselves, and we expect to contact them shortly. But we do have good signal coming from Orion. This view from inside the Orion spacecraft, all four astronauts now back on the other side of the moon and in contact with us on Earth. Their tasks for lunar flyby did not stop as they went behind the moon and out of contact with us. We anticipate during that time they were attempting to image some impact flashes, short-lived flashes on the lunar surface, which would be caused by impact bombardment and potentially even lofted lunar dust. Right now, of course, they are getting pictures of Earthrise. After this target, they will get a short observation break. It's about an hour long, actually.
Houston, Integrity, comm check.
Integrity, we have you loud and clear. How me?
Houston, we have you the same, and it is so great to hear from Earth again. To Asia, Africa, and Oceania, we are looking back at you. We hear you can look up and see the moon right now. We see you too. When we burned this burn towards the moon, I said that we do not leave Earth, but we choose it. And that is true. We will explore, we will build ships, we will visit again. We will construct science outposts, we will drive rovers, we will do radio astronomy, we will found companies, we will bolster industry, we will inspire. But ultimately, we will always choose Earth, we will always choose each other.
Integrity, from Earth, our single system, fragile and interconnected, we copy. Those of us that can are looking back.
We are happy to say we copy.
Our news this week is, well, it's going to be related because this is a banner week. I mean, this is something that is just amazing. But this story on 9 to 5 Mac really caught my eye because I was wondering about the smartphones. Originally, I only heard smartphones were on board, and then I heard they were iPhones, and then I heard they were iPhone 17 Pros. And I'm going, okay, how did that happen? Well, 9 to 5 Mac was wondering the same thing, and they based this story upon a New York Times story. New York Times did the original research and the original story. 9 to 5 Mac points to it, but I thought 9 to 5 Mac did a nice job of kind of summarizing the story, which is, here's how NASA cleared the iPhone 17 Pro Max for astronauts on Artemis 2, and I have a link, of course, in the show notes. Earlier this year, NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman confirmed that astronauts on the Artemis 2 mission would be allowed to fly with the latest smartphones. Now, the New York Times has reported what it took to make that happen. Right now, as I record this anyway, there are four iPhone 17 Pro Maxes heading home from the moon at about 25,000 miles per hour. And although this is not the first time an iPhone has been on a space mission, Artemis II marks the first time NASA has given each crew member an iPhone so they can take pictures and videos. In fact, taking photos and videos is pretty much all the devices can do, since NASA has confirmed to the Times that they can't connect to the internet or use Bluetooth. By the way, Apple said it wasn't involved with NASA's process for approving iPhones for the Artemis II mission. The company said that the mission was the first time an iPhone had fully qualified for extended use in orbit and beyond. So now clearing them for a flight wasn't a trivial task. Typically, the process has four phases. The first introduces a piece of hardware to a safety panel. The second identifies the potential hazards of the hardware, which ranges from moving parts to materials like glass that could shatter. The third lays out a plan for addressing such hazards. And the fourth proves that the plan works. The iPhone 17 Pro Max features Ceramic Shield 2 on the front and Ceramic Shield on the back, according to Apple. Ceramic Shield 2 is tougher than any smartphone glass. But shatterability wasn't the only aspect NASA had to consider, per the New York Times report. The process is meant to protect both crew and spacecraft. In a perfectly sealed capsule in microgravity, when the effects of gravity are so reduced that things appear weightless or in free fall, hardware will work in very different conditions than on Earth. Case in point, NASA discussed using Velcro to mount the phones in the Orion capsule, the agency said. Before launch, at least one of the phones was zipped into a leg pocket on a flight suit. So they got the clearance. Off to space they went, and in addition to the iPhones, the crew also has access to four GoPro Hero 11 cameras, and of course, the Nikon D5 bodies, of which I talked about a bit earlier. Now, we've already seen some of the images published with the iPhones, shared with the iPhones, and there's going to be a lot more. During one of the conversations with the crew in Mission Control, I think it was Reed, was talking about, yeah, let me just snap this picture with the iPhone and send it to you guys. I mean, this is, again, kind of like what I was talking about with the Nikon D5s. They're using tools that we have right now, and they're using them in these amazing situations. It's really phenomenal. But the bottom line is that the iPhone 17 Pro passed muster to get to the moon. And I just think that's really cool. Here's a story from F-Stoppers, how Stephen Maddow captured the Artemis II launch with 14 cameras. And this is on F-Stoppers. I have a link in the show notes. And I know you have seen some of these images if you've been following this at all. On Wednesday, April 1st, NASA's SLS rocket hurled four astronauts towards the moon for the first time in over 50 years, and Orlando-based photographer Stephen Maddow was standing at Kennedy Space Center press site with a plan years in the making. Armed with 14 Panasonic Lumix cameras spread across seven remote launch pad positions in the press site, Maddow pulled off one of the most ambitious single photographer launch coverage operations in recent memory, producing a close-up engine shot that has since gone viral around the world. And that close-up engine shot is in the article, so you definitely want to go over there and take a look at it if you haven't seen it before. You can just feel the amount of thrust coming out of those rockets. So they sat down with Maddow to ask him about some of this, and he starts out talking about his background, how many years he's been doing this, a little bit about why he likes the Panasonic cameras, you know, how he fell in love with them earlier on. And then we get into planning 14 cameras for a moon mission. And this is from the article. 14 cameras is an enormous operation for one photographer. Walk us through the strategic thinking. How did you decide on seven remote and seven press site cameras? What was each one tasked with capturing, and how did you map out focal lengths and compositions across the full set? This is his response, Stephen's response. Yeah, it was pretty wild. For this launch, I really prioritized launch pad cameras. We were brought out to 5 different spots and allowed 1 tripod per spot. I chose to place multiple cameras on some of those tripods. I was looking for compelling compositions and generally prioritized wide and medium shots. The main shot that has gone viral is a telephoto shot of the engines, which is something that I have captured of previous rockets and definitely wanted to include for this one. Since the launch was so important, I built a lot of redundancy into my plans and shot engine shots from 2 of the locations. For the straight-on shots, I did riskier super shot low down to the rocks on the crawlway and conservative alternative. I made sure to keep my favorite camera to handhold, the Panasonic Lumix G9 Mark II, with me at the press site, but generally use lower priority cameras at the press site. Here's another question that I like. You said that you were worried the launch might get scrubbed because you had to work commitments that would have prevented you from being there on a backup day. How did that anxiety play out on launch morning? Here's what he said. When I woke up on the day of the launch, I loved the positive weather forecast, but had memories of the Artemis 1 launch, which got scrubbed 7 times over the course of multiple months, going through my head. I knew that a scrub was a very realistic possibility for the day. As the day progressed, fueling, which was the biggest concern from a previous wet dress rehearsal of the rocket, went great. Confidence was rising. As we got closer, I started to hear that the team was working issues, which obviously brought up some fear that one of the issues would lead to a scrub. Ultimately, they fixed the issues and wound up launching just a few minutes into the 2-hour launch window, which was stunning. And then finally, the last question. Like I said, there are many great questions and answers in this article. Here's the last one, though, that I'm going to share with you. The question is, for a photographer reading this who has never shot a launch but wants to start, what's the single most important piece of advice you'd give them? Steven says, certainly don't expect to be able to get the same shots from 10 miles away as photographers are able to capture close-up. Haze from 10 miles in Florida is a killer. Embrace the distance and play into other fun elements. Show the crowds or interesting foregrounds. Practice, practice, practice. Relax in the moment and never forget to pause for 10 seconds to watch with your eyes. Some great stuff from Steven Maddow, who took some dynamite pictures. Man, oh man. Okay, let's take care of a little virtual camera club news. I want to give a shout out to our Inner Circle members. We're in the middle of a really cool workshop right now, and we've got a ton of Inner Circle members in it. And it's fun. And I actually nudged a few Inner Circle members who are going to be going to physical workshops later on this year to join us for this online workshop, because it's just a great way to get to know other people in the community, to share ideas. It's fun. It's just flat out fun. And it's also kind of the real life experience of, you know, what we do online the rest of the year. You know, we post pictures and we answer each other's questions and, you know, we do all that kind of stuff. But when you get to sit in a virtual room with 20 of these members, 20 of these people who are as passionate about this photography thing as we are, then it takes on a whole new dimension. And it's just been a blast. We did the first session last week. I'm getting ready for the second session this Thursday. We have more online stuff coming up. Obviously, we have physical workshops coming up. It's just wonderful to have such an active community that is so enthusiastic about their craft. And I just want to give a big shout out to our Inner Circle members for making this whole thing just wonderfully vibrant. If you're interested in joining this group, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of Digital Story, nose around a bit, sign up, and next thing you know, you'll be conversing away with this Inner Circle group just like I do every week. And I have to tell you, it is worth it. It is so much fun. And a big thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting this community. I also want to give a shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsors of the Digital Story, who are kind of upping their interaction game right now. Their printing game, that's always been upped, right? They've always been at the top of the heap on that. But now, working with Rob, and I hope you had a chance to listen to the interview I did with Rob last week about these in-person events that Red River Paper is getting behind, where you can actually, when you're at a conference, you can actually get some images printed. You can interact with people there. A lot of times it's going to be Rob. You can learn about paper. You can hold the paper. It just kind of takes something that is so visceral as printing. It takes it to the level that you really need to experience to understand why those of us who love printing so much, why we love it. You have to almost hold a print to get it. So I love what they're doing right now, and I think this is going to be a great year for Red River and a great year for all of us who are going to benefit from them and, getting to maybe see them on one of these locations. If you want to see what they're all about, all you have to do is click on the tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story, the Red River paper tile, nose around there, get some paper, start printing, and you'll see why so many of us love working with them so much. And a big thanks to them for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.